This is Justin with the Huff Finds Institute, and I wanted to remind all of you about our podcast giveaway question. Be the first one to correctly answer the question and send it to HuffFindsPodcast, that's plural, at hlkn.tamu.edu, and we will send you a Huff Finds t-shirt. So listen for the question and enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
We'd like to welcome you all here to the Huffines Institute Weekly Sports Medicine Podcast. We'd like to thank you for spending time with us, and we're really thrilled today and pleased to have Dr. Sue Bloomfield here with us today. Dr. Bloomfield is a professor here in the Department of Health and Kinesiology. She's one of the lead investigators for the National Space Biomedical Research Institute. And so welcome today, Sue.
Glad to be here.
We're going to talk a little bit today with Sue about her research interest and how it applies to everyday real world and sports medicine and all that fun stuff. Sue works in the area of bone. So tell us a little bit about your research.
Oh, wow. That's big and open-ended. I and my entire lab group, it's a team effort, investigate how bone adapts both to exercise as well as to lack of exercise. And in fact, it's that latter emphasis that interests NASA and the National Space Biomedical Research Institute because, of course, when humans fly in space, as on the International Space Station, they are weightless and lose the usual impact forces that we have on bone as we walk around on Earth. So the changes we see in bone with prolonged space flight are also very relevant to the changes that you might see in an individual here on Earth with prolonged bed rest for, after an injury, let's say, or or even after a hip fracture.
Now, you know, in the first four sentences, now you've given us enough information for the whole time to talk. There's so many interesting questions here. First of all, let me get started with bone changes. I thought bone was hard.
Okay. Yes, that's an excellent question because bone, change in bone is invisible and we can't feel it. It's one of those so-called silent diseases. Many people are aware, for example, of osteoporosis, which is one of the most common of the bone diseases incurred with aging in a large percentage of our population. In fact, a majority of women over the age of 50 will accumulate at least one vertebral fracture due to the weakened bone in their spine.
So a back fracture, just because their bone is degenerating, going away?
Yes, it's with aging, there's a gradual change in bone. There are also other factors that will affect this kind of bone loss. The loss of estrogen at menopause for women is one key factor. But less well known, there are a lot of effects such as a certain medication use that may impact on bone loss. For example, in men, the most common cause of bone loss is chronic use of anti-inflammatory medicines used for many common conditions. Prolonged alcoholism also induces bone loss. So this is not just a women's disease. It affects men and women, but predominantly those over 50 and 60. But these changes in bone, as you alluded to, are invisible. We cannot feel them. And you will not know you have bone loss until, for some reason, your physician prescribes a bone density scan. In fact, my own mother had no idea she had fairly severe osteoporosis or loss of bone until she had an x-ray for a chronic chest cold. And the x-ray itself caught up changes in her spine, in her vertebral bone. And this is not an uncommon occurrence.
Well, it's fascinating. So it's almost something that happens and you don't know it's happening.
Correct.
I guess now's the time to ask, is it too late? Can you rebuild bone?
There's good evidence that you can at least stop bone loss and in some cases reverse that loss and actually gain new bone. Depends a lot on who we're talking about, how much bone loss has been incurred, and other important factors as to whether the individual is normally weight-bearing, ambulatory, if that person eats a reasonable diet that contains enough calcium and vitamin D, but more specifically, whether that person is capable of perhaps exercising more and doing more weight-bearing exercise. This is possible for many, but not all.
Mm-hmm.
It also depends sometimes on the use of appropriate pharmaceutical agents, because there are many medications now, FDA approved, on the market that can at least slow or stop bone loss, and a few will temporarily increase or result in a gain of bone mass. Most of the medications on the market slow down bone resorption. That's what our
reabsorption. That means the
eating away of bone.
Oh, okay.
That happens as a normal part of bone turnover, but kind of gets accelerated with aging.
So I hear skin cells turn over quite a bit. So you're saying bone cells turn over as well?
Exactly.
They die and fluff
right.
off, and you make new bone cells?
Well, sort of.
Sort
yes.
of. Okay.
This,
you don't see them laying on the ground anymore.
Correct. That raises an important point. We've already said that the changes in bone are fairly invisible, and we can't feel them, right? Yes, we turn over. We make new skin cells all the time and very frequently. Bone cells live much longer than skin cells or other types of muscle cells, for example. But they do turn over. In fact, those cells are involved in resorbing or breaking down minute chunks of the mineralized matrix of bone. And that is what, in part, makes bone unique, right? Much of the bone material is not cellular. It's this heavily mineralized...
it's kind of like a scaffold, right?
Right.
Or,
a material of bone that is not cellular, does not contain cells. So the bone cells are on the surfaces of that mineralized matrix, the many, many surfaces on what we call spongy or trabecular bone. And that's the sort of bone that fills the spinal bodies, the vertebral bodies in your spine. And so that spongy lattice work of trabecular bone has a very high surface area and is exposed to a lot of cells. And that is why that is the type of bone that changes most rapidly when we change bone cell activity, say with disuse or prolonged bed rest or with estrogen deficiency, or even we are learning now with certain dietary deficiencies. Many people know that a lack of calcium in your diet is bad for your bone. Yes, indeed, if you have a very severely restricted calcium intake, you will start losing some bone material by the action of those bone cells on bone surfaces. But there's also now mounting evidence that just not eating enough calories for individuals who either are voluntarily dieting, but also those who, what we say, involuntarily restrict. Sometimes the frail elderly who just don't have an appetite and don't eat enough. Military personnel, especially out in field action, who cannot eat enough calories to keep up with their high energy expenditure during the day. These are folks that are also at a risk for kind of chronic energy deficits, and that, we are learning, also impacts on bone loss due to this.
So it sounds like there's a lot of things that impact bone that we didn't know about. Lack of activity, bed rest, caloric deficit if we get shot into space. So what's fascinating to me is how did you come to this area? I mean, this is not something I think that is talked about a lot in school, you know, to go out and or at least it wasn't in the past, about how bone is a plastic structure, changes quite
right.
a bit. So how did you come to this area?
Well, I'll be honest. I came to this by pure serendipity. I went back to graduate school later in life and decided, I had been working in a very busy research lab with Dr. John Hollisey at Washington University School of Medicine in the areas of cardiovascular and metabolic research. It was fascinating. I loved it. I had a short stint teaching at a small college before I decided, geez, I really miss this research and would like to get back. And I chose the area of bone and how bone adapts to exercise and disuse because that was the primary research target of one of my desired advisors, right? Well, but the more I looked into this, the more it made sense to me as a unique niche area in the area of exercise science, which was my discipline. And I got more and more interested in it because there are lots of fascinating applications. I was first intrigued by the surprising loss of bone that is seen in some female athletes. And this was a conundrum that occupied a lot of attention in the sports medicine realm, especially about 20, 25 years ago, when Dr. Barbara Drinkwater first studied very competitive female athletes at Stanford University and discovered that in some of those competitive female athletes, some of those individuals had bone density in their lumbar spine equivalent to 52-year-old women.
Wow.
And these are 22-year-old women.
Does that have something to do with their caloric intake?
Well,
some chance?
Over the ensuing 20 years, yes, it took quite a bit of research to get to the bottom of this. Originally, the working hypothesis was that this was due to the fact that these athletes had lost their regular menstrual cycles, a condition we call amenorrhea.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They were
mm-hmm.
no longer regularly menstruating. And we know that in that condition, which is not atypical in highly competitive female athletes, serum estrogen declines because the ovaries aren't functioning in their usual way. And we know that estrogen deficiency causes bone loss. And indeed, it is probably a contributing factor. However, then the question became, well, what causes this shutdown of regular menstruation, of regular cycling in female athletes? It was ascribed to the high levels of physical activity for many years until researchers in the late 90s discovered that what was driving this change was not so much the physical activity, but whether these female athletes were consuming enough calories to meet the caloric demands of the activity.
Mm.
In other words...
So they weren't eating enough to do what they were supposed to be doing.
Exactly. So the lack of calories, number one, causes a change in the reproductive hormone profile of female athletes. But independently now, we are discovering it also changes important metabolic hormones like growth hormone and insulin-like growth factor 1 that are important regulators not only of energy metabolism in the body, but also of bone cell activity.
Right.
So everything's related, we find out. And these chronic caloric deficits contribute to the bone loss that we see in those female athletes. So that was one intriguing question. But from an early in my graduate studies, I was a NASA geek. I was very interested in space life sciences and had the opportunity to get involved with a fellow graduate student in a rat study that was relevant to changes that we see with space flight. So there are these what we call ground-based models, simulations using animal subjects to simulate the effects of non-weight-bearing or microgravity. And even though this project was designed to look at cardiovascular and metabolic outcomes, I volunteered to help on condition that I got to study some of the bones from these rats. And because the study was designed for other purposes, I didn't have particularly high hopes that I would see something significant. The project was using as an intervention during a period of simulated weightlessness a certain drug. It's a long story, but 5 years later, I had a publication in Journal of Applied Physiology resulting from those studies. And incredibly, we found that this sympathetic nervous system mimetic minimized, didn't prevent, but it did mitigate the bone loss that we saw with this simulated weightlessness treatment in the rats.
Right.
So that started me on a road of studying disuse changes in bone that would be relevant to spaceflight changes.
Well, that's neat. As I've listened to you talk here, there appears to be several analogies between earthbound individuals and spaceflight. So the stuff that we study in space is applicable to what happens on Earth
in some
situations.
Absolutely. And here's one of the most fascinating and ironic examples. If someone breaks their hip, the typical treatment will involve either immediate surgery and then a prolonged period of rehabilitation.
Which is always painful one way or the other.
Or
right.
Second,
yeah.
if a hip replacement or orthotic implant is not appropriate for that individual, then even more prolonged bed rest is prescribed for the healing of that fracture. The restriction to bed, no weight bearing on the legs, will produce pretty profound bone loss, which of course aggravates the entire situation.
So how long does someone have to be in bed before they start losing bone?
We can measure some changes even within a month. Now that sounds like a prolonged period, but for some severe injuries or in the frail elderly, that's not unheard of.
So I'm not losing bone at night when I sleep?
Absolutely not.
So it's okay if I do sleep 8 hours.
Right. And in fact, a fascinating set of studies that looked at just that question studied young, healthy males that were on very strict bed rest. They could not get out of bed to use the bathroom, to shower. They had to eat propped up on one elbow. So very strictly controlled bed rest for upwards of, I want to say, 6 weeks. With this study, investigators found that if they just stood up, if they were standing for 4 hours a day, no deliberate exercise, just standing, they could mitigate the loss of bone that was observed. Now, these are very old studies using before we had the good imaging technology we have today. But it suggests, as does a lot of the ensuing research, that most of us with normal activity during the day, as long as you're weight-bearing and walking around, not sitting in the entire 20 hours that you're awake, will maintain fairly normal bone mass, assuming a reasonable diet and normal hormonal status.
Right.
Once you hit several weeks to several months of bed rest, then yes, you will start incurring surprising amounts of bone loss. So the major message there is avoid strict bed rest where you're never weight-bearing at all, at all costs.
Right. So let's come back to sports medicine for a minute. What message would you send out there, especially to young female athletes, as far as their nutrition status when they're training?
This is a tough nut to crack because
that's the message you're going to send out to them.
There are many athletes who are very weight conscious, and for good reason. There is a good performance reason to not be overweight if you're a runner, if you're a track and field athlete, and certainly if you're in the aesthetic sports like gymnastics, ice skating, diving, and so forth. However, there is a significant increase in the risk of stress fractures if that athlete goes for many months with very low serum estrogen levels. In other words, if that person is not menstruating for a prolonged period of time, that's a good indicator, not proof, but a good indicator that her estrogen status is low.
If that's happening, they should go see their doctor anyway.
Yes, if it goes for more than 2 or 3 months. If it's a female athlete, she should talk to her trainer and or her coach, because this is a rough indicator that perhaps she is not eating enough calories. To be sure, it's sometimes tough if you're a very intense athlete training 3, sometimes 4 hours every day and you have a busy schedule. Maybe you're a student as well. It's sometimes hard to get enough calories in. But this is why in the sports medicine world, we have folks trained in sports nutrition who can advise on how best to formulate a diet that can get enough calories in, even around busy schedule.
But this is important, though, isn't it? Because the things that young women in particular can do to their bones at that age can last them throughout their lifetime.
Right.
So this is a lifetime decision. If they decide not to eat, if they decide to lose weight for a sport, that they could be affecting their skeletal system for the rest of their life, basically.
Correct. I started with the example of stress fractures because that's what speaks to athletes. What speaks to athletes are immediate, short-term consequences to my athletic performance.
Sure.
You're absolutely right that if a female athlete has a chronic lack of estrogen that indicates perhaps this caloric imbalance, which also affects those important other hormones that affect bone cell activity, she will put herself at risk of having basically 50-year-old bones in her young 20s. That will certainly elevate that person's risk of developing what we call frank osteoporosis, I mean clinically defined osteoporosis, at a much younger age than if she had maintained normal caloric intake and normal bone cell activity and bone density values early in life. The problem is, as we all know, long-term risks, be it cancer risks from tobacco smoking or metabolic disease due to overeating in our youth, or the impact of restricting our caloric intake during for the sake of our athletic performance, rarely speaks to the average 20-year-old.
Sure, so they think they're immoral, right,
That's why I started with the risk of stress fracture, which is a more immediate risk.
Well, we're hoping people that are listening to the podcast are coaches and parents and other folks.
That's true.
Emphasize to their young athletes that it's wise to eat properly.
Right. Another related problem is the declining intake of that good old nutrition factor we call milk among adolescents in our society. And the group that is the poorest consumer of milk and other calcium sources related to their needs are teenage females. Mm. There's very good evidence that my nutritionist colleagues can cite in exquisite detail that the calcium and vitamin D in milk are much better absorbed than from any supplement. Mm. Supplements have their place for people who simply cannot drink milk. They might be lactose intolerant or simply can't drink enough milk to really make up for their needs.
Right.
But for young females, either milk or yogurt, food item for many athletes. There are lots of good sources, and of course, good old ice cream.
You mean ice cream's good for something, huh?
Yes, it is.
Oh, excellent.
But
getting enough calcium
and vitamin D is real important.
And this is all part of what's been called the female athlete triad. For folks that are listening, they may have heard, they may be familiar with that term. That's all part of that female athlete triad.
Yes, sports medicine colleagues in our... one of our parent organizations, American College of Sports Medicine, first defined this in the late 80s, early 90s, and there are actually some very informative position stands published by American College of Sports Medicine on the female athlete triad. It was recently revised, I believe, and published in 2006, but it's a great treasure trove of information about this. And there are also some important websites that provide a lot of good information about this that's directed to athletes, parents, coaches, and trainers.
And we'll certainly put the web address for the ACSM position stands and current comments on female athlete triad in the liner notes for this episode.
Great.
Before we get away from here, let me ask about long-term spaceflight. You know, one of the missions that we're going to do eventually down the road is go to Mars. But from what I heard you say earlier, spaceflight causes us to lose bone, and I also heard that we may not put it back on. So if we send people to Mars, which will take 3 years or so, mm-hmm. are they going to lose bone and they won't be able to come back? Or they'll be severely handicapped when they come back? Or
we haven't yet solved this problem. To put this in context, the best data that we have right now is that the average astronaut, who is male, will lose about 1% of bone mineral density at weight-bearing sites in the legs and lower spine per month. 1% per month. That sounds like a small amount, but to put it into context, the average postmenopausal woman will lose maybe 1.5% per year.
Wow.
The amount of bone loss we're seeing in male astronauts is roughly tenfold faster than the rate of bone loss seen in postmenopausal women. So this complete unloading of spaceflight.
And that's even the ones on the space station?
Well, I can't cite that precisely, but I can cite some important new information that has been derived thanks to the help of some ISS crew members who have volunteered to have clinical CT scans done before and after flight, which gives us a wealth more of information than the standard bone density scans that one might get when they go see their physician. If indeed we have a mission to Mars and the astronaut flies for 6 months and we haven't yet solved this bone loss problem with complete weightlessness, they will arrive with some significant degree of bone loss on the Mars surface. If they are then, as we expect, out working on the Mars surface, building a habitat or collecting samples, and there's some sort of fall off a ladder or an industrial accident where something falls on that crew member, they're at much higher risk of bone fracture because of not just the loss of bone mineral density, but also the changes in shape that we have seen, at least at the proximal femur near the hip. So this is an important problem to solve.
So as we wrap up here today, if you had one take-home message for people to help them prevent bone loss, alterations to their skeleton, what would you tell folks?
I would tell the public to keep in mind a good, healthy, well-rounded diet is important. But if you're interested in optimal bone health, you also have to be aware of your hormonal status. But as an exercise physiologist, I must emphasized the absolute key role of regular physical activity and, at a minimum, avoiding prolonged periods of sitting during the day. You must at least interrupt them with a walk to get lunch, a walk from the bus to get home, a walk to where you parked your car far away in the parking lot, just to avoid prolonged periods of sitting and inactivity. Better if you can be physically active with weight-bearing exercise during the week, but avoiding the disuse changes and prolonged sitting and certainly prolonged periods in bed unless absolutely necessary.
Well, and that's a great message to end with, because we're always telling people that they need to be active to be healthy. And so that's a great way to end. And so thank you, Dr. Bloomfield, for being with us today.
We'd like to thank you for taking the time to join us today, for taking the time to download us. We remind you that you can go to our website at huffinesinstitute.tamu, and that's tamu.edu. Click on the podcast link, and there you'll see all the podcasts that we've done. Just go ahead and subscribe right there, and that way automatically every Friday, those will be downloaded to your computer for your listening pleasure. Now, for the Huff Eins t-shirt this week, the first person who emails us at huffeinspodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu will win a free t-shirt, and you can't beat that. Our question for the week is, what is an important physiological problem that we have to solve in spaceflight? Dr. Bloomfield talked about it. Many people are talking about it. So write that in, send us a quick email, and you'll be the proud recipient of a Huff Eins podcast t-shirt. Well, we're come to the end of our podcast today. Justin, is there anything else we need to take care of? He's shaking his head no. Let me thank you once again for joining us, and we just hope that you have an active and healthy week.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Justin Dobson and licensed by the Huff Eins Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huff Eins family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffeinspodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huff Eins Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.